I was thinking about campfires lately, and someone had commented that the lighting in my recent videos has a campfire-like atmosphere, I guess. And it made me think of kindling, which reminded me of something else that I'm going to discuss in this video. And I realized that if I tried to snap one of those kindling sticks, it'd be pretty easy, right? Because it's sort of brittle. But a bundle of those sticks, on the other hand, well, that becomes more formidable. That's where the word fascio comes from, by the way, which is an Italian word that means bundle or binding. Now, fascio originates from the Latin word fasces, which symbolizes strength and unity. And so this leads us to a word that we hear being thrown around often lately: fascism. So people usually view fascism as a grand operatic evil. But at the root, it's really just a hardware store metaphor for being tired of feeling brittle. So it's something like, I don't know, imagine the sound of 1,000 fragile people banding together and deciding they'd rather be a blunt instrument. Now, I've been trying to wrap my head around why that word is everywhere again. And I guess this includes the cartoon version that gets used as an insult, but it's also, I think, the way some people are looking at each other across the grocery store aisles these days. Now, it's not exactly 1933, of course, and things have obviously changed, but there does seem to be a particular exhaustion in the air that's like idling in a traffic jam for 10 years until the tank is running on fumes, and you just want someone to just drive through the fence or whatever and smash a way out. Most people don't realize that the Italian dictator Mussolini was a socialist before he was anything else. He didn't start out with this world domination mindset. He started out with a loud voice, talking to people who felt somehow cheated. So in 1915, Italy was essentially bribed to switch sides in World War I and join the Allies, France, the British Empire, and Russia. And Italy was promised huge swaths of territory if they did this. Now, the problem is, by the end of the war, the Allies went back on many of their promises and they never delivered. Italy lost 650,000 soldiers in World War I. And on top of that, it was left in an economic and social chaos. So, needless to say, they felt a little cheated. So the Italians called this the mutilated victory, because technically they were on the winning side, but they were left in this disastrous situation. So Mussolini gathered veterans, guys who spent years in trenches, learning that the only things that matter are a bullet and the man standing next to you. And they came home to a world of unproductive debates and inflation that turned their worthless savings into literal wallpaper. So, so you can see why the bundle looks good at that point, because you stop being a person with a failing farm and you become an axe in the middle of the sticks, which was the symbol the fascists utilized. So needless to say, they were a rather angry lot. Okay, so then there's Hitler, who was watching all this from the sidelines like a fanboy. Germany was basically a corpse being picked over by creditors by the end of the war. So you'd go to the go into a bakery with a wheelbarrow of cash, and by the time you reached the front of the line, the price had gone up so much that you couldn't even afford the crust. That kind of humiliation makes a master narrative feel like pure oxygen. Now, Hitler didn't just give the German people someone to blame. He gave them a story where they were the protagonist. So he took some garbled 19th century linguistics about Aryans and turned it into like a bloodline fantasy. And he told the German people that their DNA was a secret superpower. Now that is a powerful drug. You know, being told that you're part of some elite lineage when you're eating boiled cabbage for the 10th night in a row. But these guys, they didn't just seize power. They were basically invited, because the respectable people in power, the businessmen who thought they were the adults in the room, they looked at these violent men and thought, we can use them. They'll keep the communists quiet, and we'll put them back in the cage when we're done. This was their thinking. Well, that obviously turned out to be a huge mistake. Because you don't invite a fire into your house because you're cold and you expect it to stay in the fireplace. It's probably going to burn everything. And that's exactly what happened. But, you know, hubris, ego, these things can be fatal. I remember a few years ago, I was walking through a mall, and I'd say at least half the storefronts were shuttered, and the rest sold mostly junk or fast fashion that ends up in a landfill in a matter of weeks. In the whole atmosphere, it was like one giant, eerie liminal space. That's kind of how I see malls. And there was a guy sitting on a bench, staring at a fountain that wasn't running. And it looked like he'd been there since 1998 or something. You know, we always talk about the politics of this, but we don't usually talk about the boredom and the stagnation. So the 20th century guys, they thrived on high octane chaos. You had to be in the street screaming and doing violence. But the 21st century version feels more like a slow leak in a tire. You don't wake up one morning and find a dictator marching on your lawn. You wake up and you realize that the, you notice on the news, the local judge who used to be seen as a decent person is now tweeting about purity or something. You realize the news, in addition to being, to providing some sort of biased reporting, also tells you who to hate for what might happen tomorrow or the near future. It's an insidious form of nationalism because it doesn't ask you to replace your democracy. It's just asking you to just let it go a little bit. Like a shoe that's a little too tight. You just want to kick it off. Back in the 1930s, the fascist playbook was, it was loud and bloody. And, you burned down the parliament, or you sent guys in leather coats to smash windows and beat up certain citizens. It was theatrical. You knew exactly where the line was as you crossed it. Now, these days, why bother with the fire and all the theatrics? Fire brings sanctions and bad public relations. So if you are a modern-day aspiring autocrat, you do it mainly through the plumbing, so to speak. So in other words, you change how districts are drawn. You gerrymander. You team up with technocrats to implement omnipotent surveillance tactics. You make it a miserable six-hour ordeal in bad weather for the wrong people to vote. You pass a law that says the government can investigate journalists who ask too many questions. Or you might even just ignore the laws altogether and apprehend people anyway. So it's like democracy by name, but the spirit has been more or less sucked out of it. I keep coming back to the, mythologized past, because it's arguably the most effective hook in history. There's that old line, remember the good old days before those people showed up and ruined the neighborhood. The trick is the so-called golden age, it never actually happened, at least not the way people remember it. It was more accurately just a highlight reel of a summer that lasted for 5 minutes, edited to remove the low-key human rights violations and the polio and the lead paint and so forth. But it doesn't matter if it's true. It only matters that it's a place to hide. If you're the guy sitting by the broken fountain in the mall, and someone tells you that your empty bank account isn't just bad luck, that it's a deliberate theft by some fabricated scapegoat enemy, that is a hell of a drug. And what this does is it turns your apathy into an identity. And there's a name for this sort of, I guess, soft, covert form of fascism. illiberalism. And this is what I think is more accurately what we're experiencing. Even though we hear the word fascism all the time. This is a system. So illiberalism is a system that keeps the shell of democracy, the appearance. So the voting and the speeches, etc. But it basically guts the actual freedoms that make it work. And it's much more relaxing than liberalism. Old school liberalism is high maintenance. You know, it requires you to tolerate people you don't like, and that losing an election, you know, accept that losing an election isn't going to be the end of the world. Illiberalism is like a shortcut. And it casually says, okay, you're right. Those people are the problem. If we just tighten the screws on them, everything goes back to the way it was in the pretty postcards. So basically, it's fascism, but it's fascism wearing a fleece vest. It's almost like cozy fascism. It doesn't need a salute or any rambunctious rallies. It just needs a like and a share. I was looking at the settings on my phone, and there's that, I guess, emergency section tucked behind three menus. And you never really look at this until the car's upside down in a ditch, right? So that's how I've been thinking about constitutions. We treat constitutions like these holy slabs of granite, but really they're just software. And you know, like any software, they have backdoors that people forgot to patch. The 1930s, the fascists in the 1930s were like hackers who just crashed the server. They burned the building, and then they said, we are the operating system now. But the new illiberal types, they don't crash the server. They're a lot more discreet. What they do is they change the permissions one by one while you're distracted on your phone or whatever bread and circus it might be. I heard about a law that was created to ensure administrative efficiency in the courts. Okay, that sounds great. I mean, I want my plumbing to be efficient, and so do you, I hope. But efficiency in this context is just, it's a code word for, we're picking the judges who like us and firing the ones who don't. And they do this through some boring legislative session on a Tuesday while everyone's preoccupied arguing about, you know, whatever latest culture war scandal is happening. So there's no jackboots. There's just a signature on a piece of paper that looks like a grocery receipt. So back in the 20th century, fascism was more like an explosion or like a series of developing explosions. But in the 21st century, it's more like I guess, a leak. If you have an explosion, you're going to call the fire department. And, you know, there's drama. But if you have a leak, maybe you just sort of get used to the damp smell in the basement. You go down there, you put a bucket under it, mop it up, whatever. You tell yourself it's always been like this. Until one day, the foundation has rotted and the whole house is tilting. Great. So the ironic joke here is that the architects of illiberalism, they use the language of democracy to kill it. So they talk about the, you know, you hear the will of the people, as if the people is a single organism with one opinion. Conveniently, the leaders. And if you disagree, you aren't an opposition party anymore. You're now an enemy of the people. Which makes you the stick that won't get in the bundle. You defiant little bastard. And if you won't get in the bundle, well, then you're the one that's going to get snapped and probably get used as kindling for the fire that they plan to build eventually. So I walked past a construction site recently, and I saw a sign that said, I think it said something like, "Pardon our dust, we're building a better tomorrow." Someone had drawn a dick on the sign. And I stood there, staring at the hole in the ground. And I realized that's kind of what it feels like to live in a decaying system. We're all standing around the hole, looking at the graffitied sign. We're wondering if tomorrow is ever going to show up. And when it doesn't, well, then naturally we look for someone to blame. So the autocrats are still making the same bet. They think that they can ride the tiger, so to speak. And they think that as long as the stock market is up and the efficiency laws keep the workers compliant, they're going to be safe. Now, the way I see it, tigers don't care about your portfolio. They care about who's next on the menu. There's this specific spot here on my table in the wood grain that looks like a kind of like a screaming face if when the light hits it just right. And I've lived here for a number of years and I've never noticed it until around a week ago. And now I can't unsee it. And I think that's kind of what the myth of the outsider does. Once someone points out the so-called enemy, you start seeing them everywhere. They're in the news, they're in the schools, they're the reason your insurance went up, they're the reason you can't afford insurance at all, they're the reason you have a headache. I mean, you know, it's like I see it as like a cognitive hack. You take the messy reality of a failing economy and collapse it into a single ghost. So, in the 1930s, you needed a physical rally to get that feeling of oneness, the fervor of the herd. You had to stand in a stadium and chant slogans, breathing the same air until your throat was raw. And of course, these days now we have, I guess, the digital version of this. And I think this version is actually a hell of a lot more effective. And the bundle of sticks doesn't need to be in the same town anymore. Because now we're all tied together by fiber optic cables. This is the new bundle. We're all separately together in our little bubbles, feeding on all this curated outrage. And to stay in the bundle, you have to be the most loyal. You have to hate the enemy the loudest. If you show a little bit of nuance, you know, exercise a tiny bit of critical thinking, and maybe you say, hey, that guy isn't a monster. Maybe he's just a little confused. Well, then the bundle starts to tighten. And maybe this is where you realize, or you start to realize, that the bundle isn't just for protection. It's for keeping you in line. I see people talking about the truth like it's some physical object that they found in the woods or wherever. And I think doing your own research, it has its pros and cons. But in some cases, from a certain perspective, it usually means finding a map drawn in a crayon by someone even angrier than the people that they want to convince that their suspicion is actually a superpower. That's how the charismatic leader works now. He doesn't have to be a good orator. He just has to be like a mirror. So he reflects back the anger and he says, they think you're stupid, but I think you're the only one who gets it. So this is like the ultimate manipulative us versus them loop. And I think it thrives because, well, liberal democracy, you know, the boring kind, it relies on the idea that we can disagree without wanting to delete each other. It relies on the referees, the independent press, the nonpartisan judges. But the illiberal strategy is to kill the referees first. You don't fire them. You just make them look like players on the other team. You say stuff like, well, the news is fake and the judges are activists. And well, once you destroy the idea of any neutral ground, you're left with nothing but the struggle. And in the struggle, you don't want a representative. You just want a strong man. You want the biggest stick in the bundle to be the one holding the axe. I think one of the most visible aspects about politics lately is that we've traded any semblance of progress for vengeance. I saw a sticker on a poll the other day that just said, losing yet? No candidate, no policy, no, you know, just a middle finger, basically. So back in the old days, or at least in the version of history most of us want to believe, you voted for someone because they promised to build bridges. it was, I guess there was a lot more talk about connection and unity than there was about division. But these days, of course, it's seems to be quite clear that division is the narrative. And there's a lot of people out there voting for the candidate who promises to do the most damage to the people they don't like. That's their primary motivation, sadly. So vengeance has become like a form of public service almost. It's the primary export of the illiberal project. When your life feels stuck in neutral, when you're working three jobs and you still can't afford a house, at that point you usually stop caring about bridges. You just want to see the winners lose, and you want to see the people who look down on you feel a little bit of the panic that you feel every time you open a utility bill or something. And the 20th century fascists, they knew this. And they knew how to spread propaganda to the point or to point the blame at the wrong people. Mussolini talked about the, what he called the purifying power of violence. I think the modern version is cleaner, but it's ultimately the same ugly instinct. It's a politics of subtraction. So it's like saying, well, if I can't have a better life, at least I can try my damnedest to make sure yours is just as bad, if not worse. And that's why the charismatic leader doesn't actually have to fix anything. He doesn't have to lower the price of gas or fix the healthcare system or what have you. All he has to do is stay on the attack. Every time he mocks a judge or blames and demeans a minority group, his supporters feel a tiny jolt of power. It's kind of like a drug. It isn't going to fill your stomach, but it'll appease the hunger for a few seconds. I have this clock on my wall that's been broken for like a year or something. And the hands just kind of twitch in place, clicking away. So it's trying to move forward, but the gears are basically stripped. Now, I think that's representative of a large number of people out there. They are the twitching clock, stuck in a loop of grievance where the only thing that feels real is the fight. And the mainstream elites love the twitching because it keeps the masses focused on grievances and distractions and not noticing the ledger or how the efficiency laws are moving the last of the wealth into offshore accounts. So the autocrats feed the tiger meat and hope that it stays in the cage. But I think that they are forgetting that the tiger doesn't work for them. Not really. I mean, it doesn't even work for the people. The tiger just works for the tiger. The normalization of all of this is, it's a subtle process that I think happens more with a yawn than a bang. these days, the coordination is voluntary. People join the bundle because I think, for better or for worse, that's just human nature. In an illiberal system, you don't necessarily feel oppressed. I think you just feel seen, but not in a good way. So you're given a team jersey and a list of people to blame. And once you're in that headspace, you'll forgive or you'll overlook anything. Gutted courts, silenced press, facts, blatant constitutional corruption, violence. I mean, at this point, the list just goes on and on. So we just, we trade our agency for the comfort of the cage. And I think the autocrats still believe that they can just use this energy to pass tax cuts and then send the strong man away when they want. Which I think is delusional. I mean, this is a different beast these days. And I think it's hungry for the same thing that the 1930s crowds wanted, which is essentially the rush of being right and the sight of the punishment of someone else being wrong, to whatever end that might be. And we've all seen how that's played out before. You know, we've spent over 80 years at this point believing that we'd outgrown our ugly instincts. And we weren't going to go back. But I think the information, it didn't make us immune. Unfortunately, all it did was make the infection spread faster. And this current version of decay that we're experiencing, it doesn't have a clear ending like a 1945 bunker. It's like a slow motion car crash where we keep drifting into the ditch. And I think the pattern, it's already here with the focus or the obsession with the humiliation of the enemy. And I think maybe it's entirely possible that the bundle is just our natural state, and these last few decades were just a fluke. I don't want to accept that. I think studying the source code of these movements involves noticing, you know, we need to recognize the itch before it becomes a festering wound. But the human condition, I mean, there's nothing like it. And it's fundamentally the root of all this trauma. I think our only real defense here is we just got to refuse to be part of the fascio, the bundle. We got to try to be the stick that just stays on the ground, independent, but still part of its natural habitat, maybe a little vulnerable, but true to itself, self-aware, and hopefully, ultimately, unbroken. I don't know what else to say. I guess that's all I've got on this topic for today. As always, thanks for listening.